Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today the Administrative Director of the Office of Court Administration, David Slayton. David is a very popular figure in Texas legal circles these days, and we're looking forward to visiting with you, David, and having you tell us what you're up to.
Thanks. Glad to be with you today. Looking forward to chatting today.
So before we dive in, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and what you did before you joined OCA?
Yeah, so I got my start in the court system like many people who work for courts, which was kind of by accident. I started working, needed a job during college, and actually started filing documents in the basement of a courthouse in Lubbock County when I was a Red Raider. So worked my way through the system there, became a court clerk for a judge, and went to federal court for a few years, worked in federal court in Lubbock as well as in Dallas, was managing a couple of sections of the Dallas clerk's office, federal clerk's office. I'm back to Lubbock, was a court administrator there for 8 years, and I've been here at the Office of Court Administration as the administrative director for the past 8 years. Anniversary was just last week, so.
Happy anniversary.
Thanks very much.
Doesn't seem that long.
It's gone by pretty fast, although the last 2 months have seemed like 14 years, so.
You go years hearing about the OCA, but you don't really know that much about it other than statistics. And then in about the last 2 months, I think I've heard more about OCA than I have the entire time I've been licensed, really.
Yeah, we've been more involved than we normally are. We normally like to play a nice quiet role behind the scenes, and this pandemic has certainly put us out front a little more. And we've been happy to play the role of support and assistance where we can. And hopefully we've done a good job, and we hope to keep doing a good job to the degree we can.
You kind of explain a little bit what OCA does. It's one of those things that I kind of know about, but would like to hear a better description from you.
OCA was actually formed in 1977. It's a judicial branch agency created by the legislature. And when 1977 it was created, there's actually some papers that I found in my office from Chief Justice at the time, where he was basically begging the legislature for a judicial branch agency to assist the Supreme Court in the administration of the courts. Obviously, the court has a busy job handling cases, writing the rules, dealing with things, but all the other stuff that goes on day to day with the court is a challenge for them. So whether it's collecting statistics, as you mentioned, you know, trying to look at the trends, what's going on with the courts, making policy recommendations, providing technology. So we provide the technology for all of the appellate courts and some of the technology for the trial courts and all the judicial branch agencies, to budget issues, to being the face of the branch to the legislature. So all of those are kind of things we do. We work with the Texas Judicial Council. I'm the executive director of the Judicial Council as well in my role as director of OCA. And so we advocate for policy changes with the legislature. And that's the bottom line of what we do. It's a pretty broad mission, but just everything we can do to help the court with the administration of the courts.
You mentioned that some trial courts have a little different system. Are we talking about like the case management systems that are administered on the local level?
Yeah, this is actually changing right now, but up until now, every court clerk in each county has the option of choosing with their commissioner's court to choose a case management system. So we have some courts that have really sophisticated case management systems and some of them that have none at all. And so they provide that, but we have to work with them to interact with the e-filing system and other things. We're actually, this last legislative session, we were provided funding to provide case management system that's targeted to the counties under 20,000 in population, which is 130 of the counties, so over half the state's counties.
Wow. And
obviously, it's not really mandatory for them, but we're going to make it available to them. And our goal, obviously, is to have a robust case management system that will serve their needs and hopefully serve the needs of the bar and the public better.
Fabulous. You mentioned working with the appellate courts, too. And I mean, that's where I know you from, is I see your name in connection with one of our other previous guests, Blake Hawthorne, a lot. And you guys are both great about being very public-facing and in your jobs, and people can figure out pretty quickly what OCA is and what you do just by watching you online. And Blake is excellent at that too. But so where, you know, Jody and I are both appellate lawyers, and that's our focus. And so we happen to see you in that capacity more, but is your role really different when it comes to dealing with the appellate courts and supporting them?
I think OCA overall, I mean, we provide more support for the appellate courts. Obviously, there are over 3,000 judges at the trial court level. Dealing with the 98 appellate court judges and justices is a little more manageable. And so, you know, we're providing literally the front level support to their computers on their desktop, to their case management system, to helping them with legislative stuff, keeping them informed about what's going on. We staff their Council of Chief Justices, where all the chiefs get together and discuss issues. They're providing the TAME system for all the appellate courts. And our level of interaction is more with the appellate courts than with the trial courts on a day-to-day basis, just because it's a little easier to have that more in-depth interaction with them because there's so fewer of them.
Thank y'all for all you do with the TAME system, because that makes our jobs so much easier to be able to access all that stuff online and get to it and pull it up. It really has streamlined appellate practice in a very significant way.
Yeah, you know, we're trying, you know, and you've mentioned Blake, you know, all the clerks of all the appellate courts, as well as the justices, you know, they're always trying to be forward thinking. And of course, we want to support that as much as we can and be as forward thinking with them and try to think about how can we make not only the internal users, but primarily the external users, you all as appellate lawyers and the litigants who are and the public, how can we make that as simple and streamlined as we can for them as they interact with the appellate courts? So it's always a focus of ours to try to think through those things and make those improvements where we can.
Yeah, it's really nice to be able to pull up all the briefing in a particular case and all that and not have to go through potentially 254 different systems to get to it and just have a standardized platform across the whole state for all the courts and the Supreme Court.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, that's really the practice has changed immensely in the last 10 years. In talking with Blake before, we kind of attributed all to the advent of mandatory electronic filing. And now, of course, in the situation we're all in with still pretty much working from home, that turned out in hindsight to be just a tremendous development.
Yeah.
Because we're working from home and really not missing a beat.
It's really interesting because a few weeks ago, I texted Chief Justice Jefferson, who of course was the chief at the time that mandatory e-filing went into effect. And I always tell everybody the story that's kind of funny about that order is the day that order was signed, mandating e-filing, was the anniversary of the day I started filing documents in the basement of the Lubbock County Courthouse. So I sort of felt like that was just maybe fate was sending me a message that no more paper, whether it's Hurricane Harvey or this pandemic. The Texas court system has not shut down. If you look, I mean, it's unfortunate, but New York's court system, they stopped filing. I mean, they have not been filing cases in 2 months. They do not permit filing except for emergency matters. And they've not been able to hold hearings over the past 2 months except for emergency matters. And I mean, one of the things that I think we should be really proud of is the fact that those steps that we started taking many years ago have really laid the foundation for us to be able to continue to operate at a level that not only any other state is operating at right now. And not to say that we're operating as functioning as well as we would like to be, but it's certainly in a way that had we not had electronic filing and some of the other things we've done over the past 8 to 10 years, 12 years, we wouldn't have been there. So when I texted Chief Justice Jefferson, I said, I remember, I guess it was 2013 or so, actually it was 2012, I guess, whenever the mandate came down. I remember being in a conference with the justices of the court and saying, okay, are we okay? Everybody okay signing this mandatory electronic filing order? I mean, it's a big step back then if you think about it. And I remember there was some uncertainty and some, for the most part, everybody really thought about it and said, this is the right thing to do. Let's do it. And now looking back, I can't imagine where we would be if we hadn't have done that many years ago.
No kidding. And, you know, we were talking before we started recording, you mentioned there's some statistics about just the number of remote proceedings that we've been able to have as a result of that. Do you have those with you?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the other thing that's kind of interesting is, you know, the Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals, on the very first day they were given the emergency powers under this pandemic, which is the same day the governor declared a disaster, the statute gives the Supreme Court that authority on that declaration. March the 13th, they entered an order permitting and actually requiring in certain situations remote proceedings. And over that weekend, we tried to explore what are the options we could use to do this? We sort of came up with the platform we ended up choosing. And the next week we got about 20 licenses. We already had an account. We got 20 more licenses and asked 20 judges across the state, hey, try this out, see what you think, see how it goes. By the end of the week, they were saying, this is wonderful. That Friday, so 1 week after the court signed the order, we had a webinar with the judges to say, here's how you can use Zoom to do remote proceedings. Here's where you go to sign up. That next Monday, we started signing people up. So Tuesday, March 24th is the day we started really having virtual or remote proceedings through Zoom. And we've got over 1,400 judges with accounts on the system. And in those just over 6 weeks since we did that, there have been 17,000 separate proceedings, 17,000 separate meetings. We estimate conservatively that each one of those had 3 to 4 hearings in them, because I know some judges are having 50 to 80 hearings in one meeting, like a big docket of criminal pleas or appearances or whatever. So probably somewhere over 60,000 hearings in the last 6 weeks over that. And those numbers just keep going up. I mean, you know, last week we were averaging over 750 meetings a day. So it's pretty remarkable about the fact that the judges just were so quick to embrace that from the two high courts, you know, saying, we're going to embrace the remote technology. We're going to allow judges to do it without the participants' consent so we can keep the justice system moving. There was conversation at the highest levels of the court saying, this time is bringing a lot of uncertainty to people's lives and instability to people's lives. The courts are not going to be one of those things that are uncertain or unstable in this time. And we're going to be here to be able to resolve disputes in the best way we can and just try to keep going forward. And I think for the most part, we've done that. Yeah, we've not been able to handle everything, you know, jury trials being a big one that we've not been able to do, but we've handled every other type of proceeding through remote technology, trials, oral arguments, whatever it may be. It's all happened remotely during this time when, quite frankly, if we didn't have the technology in place, we'd be at a standstill like some of the other states.
That's amazing. And a real testament to forward thinking and planning long before this that put these things in place.
Yeah, one other stat I should mention, I didn't say this, but the other thing that I think is really exciting is that we've had 214,000 participants in those proceedings. It's been broad. We've been able to get people from all across the state able to participate and be able to have their day in court. If we would have done like some of the other states have done and said, we're only going to do emergency matters or essential matters, yeah, we could have done that. But I keep saying, to the people who have cases in our court systems, it doesn't matter what we classify it. To them, it's essential and emergency.
Absolutely.
So we're able to, whether it's that adoption of that child that maybe wouldn't have happened for months because of the fact that that probably would not be, that would not be deemed an essential matter or an emergency matter. And so it would have had to wait for who knows how long at this point, actually. Or if it's the divorce proceeding where the kids can know who's going to have custody or visitation, or it's the criminal defendant, they're not in jail, the criminal defendant on bond who wants to get the case resolved, or a victim who's waiting for that case to be resolved. I mean, all those things have happened just like they would have in the old days. The other thing I think that's interesting is 17,000 separate meetings, and the most any single judge has had is 250. So if you think about that for a second, again, widespread usage across the state. So anyway, we're really pleased with the work that the courts have done over the last couple of weeks. And I think the people of Texas should be proud of the work that their judges have done.
I think my other favorite thing about all this is the fact that all the courts now have YouTube channels, so I can watch hearings of any kind anywhere across the state. I hope that that sticks around afterwards, because I love it just to be able to tune into these kind of courts wherever and just see what's going on.
It's interesting because, you know, I mean, as director of OCA, I don't get to go in the courtroom much anymore. I mean, when I was in Lubbock, I was there with the judges and a couple of associate judges. And so I could walk in and listen and see what's going on. And since I've been here, I've been in a couple of courtrooms just, you know, as I travel and things. But for the most part, I don't see the judges. And it's been really interesting. And I think the other thing that's interesting is I think it gives the people, the citizens of Texas who generally don't know anything about their court system and certainly ill-informed, it gives them the ability to see justice in a way that they wouldn't otherwise see. And you know, you can log on to a court hearing. And I know I was on a hearing, a very sort of, maybe it was earlier this week or last week, I can't remember now, they all run together. And there were over 600 people watching. The Supreme Court's oral argument, their last oral argument, had at one point 1,200 people on it watching. Even though the court's been streaming its oral arguments for some time, we've never had that level of interest. And I think it's because people know it's out there and they can find it easily on the YouTube channel. And I think it's a good thing if the public sees the work of its courts. And we'll see what stays around and what doesn't. I think we can talk more about that. I've been saying my hashtag is not going back. It's kind of what I think.
Well, anyone who's listened to this show knows that we're generally advocates of using technology and delivery of legal services, and particularly with respect to courts and filings. I certainly hope that we don't go back. It's interesting because I'm in conversation with some of our local judiciary about their procedures. And even Travis County is a big county, you know, pretty tech savvy judiciary, but they are perhaps not surprisingly saying, we don't anticipate that we're going to go back to the way things were completely. There are just certain types of matters that you don't have to have your client sitting around the courthouse all day waiting around to get reached on a central docket. And Travis County is pretty good about reaching people, you know, relatively fast, but there are other counties that I go to from time to time, more rural counties, where it is literally an all-day affair to have a 30-minute hearing. If we could get the judges in those counties comfortable with the technology and being able to do things using Zoom, to me, it just presents a tremendous advantage in efficiency, frankly, in access to justice, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been saying, to me, I think the biggest takeaway for me in this is the ability to expand access to justice in a way that we could not have done 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. Whether it's, let's say one of you decide you're going to take a pro bono case in Mason County. You've got to obviously figure out a way to meet with your client. Maybe you can do that over the phone, or maybe you do that on video. But whenever it's time for the hearing, you've got to drive the couple of hours it is over there. You've got to wait perhaps hours for the judge to get to your case behind the criminal case or the family law case or whatever it is, for your 15 minutes that you need to have your hearing, and then drive a couple hours back. And from a pro bono perspective, I mean, that's hard for lawyers to think about taking that much time away from their practice to go do that. But if instead you can sit at your desk and be working on your appellate brief or the other cases you're working on, and then you're in the Zoom waiting room waiting, and then when it's your turn, you pop up on the screen and here you go, and you do your 15 minutes and then you go back to your work. I mean, the potential there is huge to being able to expand access, just especially in our rural areas of the state where, quite frankly, we just don't have lawyers. And, you know, if it's a language interpretation, we've got lots of places in the state where we have people who don't have access to interpreters. If you're west of I-35 and you're not El Paso, good luck finding an interpreter for the courts. All of a sudden, we have interpreters now appearing via Zoom and doing the interpretation in ways just completely seamless, or court reporters. I mean, just keep going down the list. And then just the impact on litigants. I've been talking with Judge Ferguson out in Brewster County. I mean, think about people having to drive to court to go in Brewster County. I mean, it's hours of driving, or if you're in Houston, you know, driving from West Harris County downtown to the courthouse, finding parking, finding childcare. I mean, just the efficiency from the system overall and the ability to expand access to justice is tremendous. And so I think what you said is not unique to Travis County judges. Almost every judge I've talked to, I've gotten several emails today from judges who are looking at their plans for post June 1st, and they're saying, we've got to keep using Zoom as long as we can. Please don't get rid of our licenses, because they've found the value. Obviously, there's going to be some cases where it's going to be in the courtroom, but you know, to the degree we can still use it, the better we are.
You all at OCA, you know, have played a big role in getting the judges comfortable with the technology. How have you reached out to the judges in the more rural counties who maybe, you hate to make assumptions about judges or anyone really, but it's not surprising that judges in Travis County or Tarrant County, Dallas County, Harris County would be easily transitioned into this kind of technology. And I think Judge Ferguson is the exception as far as rural counties go, but he's also, as we know, been a leader in this area. How were your communications, or what kind of communications did you have with the more rural judiciary to try to bring them into the fold on using Zoom?
Yeah, I'll defend my rural buddies. As a guy who grew up in very rural Texas, it's been really great to watch them just quickly embrace it. We've not had to pull anybody along for the most part. I think to some degree, the folks in the rural areas actually see the bigger benefit of this, because, you know, think about many of those rural judges are circuit riding judges who have to drive hours and hours to go to their next courthouse over to do a half day of hearings, versus now they can sit in their house or their courtroom or wherever they're at, and they can do those. And so I think they've quickly embraced that. And while they might not have been exposed to technology in the past, they've quickly taken that on now. This is one of the reasons why I'm not trying to be a commercial for Zoom, but that's why we chose a Zoom platform. was because we wanted to find something that was really user-friendly. We knew if it was difficult for judges and if it was difficult for attorneys or litigants, we could not make it successful. That was one of the main things we looked at is it really, really simple to use? And, you know, we did a webinar. We set up a Zoom helpline, basically, where judges and court staff can call. And they are very busy. They get two staff that's pretty much all they're doing all day long every day. And they're spending an hour on the phone saying, no, click here, click here, click here. But it's been working really well. And so far, we haven't had really any judges who say, I can't do this or it's too hard. So I don't think it's really a rural urban divide. We've seen pretty much widespread adoption across the state.
Have you seen the same kind of response in the appellate courts that you have in the trial courts? You know, it's a little bit different since you know you're going for 40 minutes worth of argument in the appellate court, kind of more at a traditional time.
Yeah, I think the appellate courts, you know, obviously we've got the Supreme Court having already done oral arguments. The 13th has already done oral arguments. The 8th has had a couple. I know the 4th is scheduled in a couple of weeks to do oral arguments. I know the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to do oral arguments all via remote technology. And so all using Zoom. And I don't have a confirmation of this. I asked them all to give me confirmation before this conversation. But I know the 7th, I'm pretty sure the 7th has as well. Maybe some of the others have. I don't think they've had any, they've been quick to do it. You know, I emailed them back several weeks ago and said, hey, do this and talk about it. And so we got them all accounts. They all signed up. They all started using it for internal conferences and purposes. And it's allowed them to keep functioning just as well. The oral argument's a little bit more difficult and complicated because there's a lot of moving parts. Having helped run the Supreme Court's oral argument every time, it's like a TV show on the backside a little bit. You should see our script for it, the way it works. Our goal was to make sure that for appellate lawyers and for the justices, that they had to worry about nothing but what they would have normally worried about in the courtroom. So the justices, basically the only thing we asked them to do was mute and unmute themselves. That's it. Everything else, we moved them where they needed to be. We made sure their backgrounds were good. We made sure their audio was good. We made sure the attorneys, the same thing. We tried to get the attorneys in the room, get them comfortable, and then basically told them, I'm going to mute you. I'm going to turn off your camera. And basically that way, our goal was with oral arguments to make sure, you know, if we're going to do it this way, there's a job that's happening here. This is just an online courtroom. We don't want them to be worrying about, oh, I don't know if my video's on or whatever, because you've got to focus on what you're there to do. Same thing for the judges. We wanted them focusing on the same things they'd be focusing on in the courtroom. At least having talked to the lawyers who have done the four oral arguments in the Supreme Court, the justices of the Supreme Court, their response to me, which was a little shocking, to be honest, was, I don't think anything was lost. And so I was really pleased to hear that from them, that they felt like even doing it remotely was good. And I actually heard Chief Justice Hecht, I don't know if every appellate lawyer will love this, but Chief Justice Hecht on a national webinar said that he doesn't think that we've seen the last Zoom oral argument in the Supreme Court either. So I think we may see some of that going forward, you know, especially if, let's say, counsel is from El Paso and they say, we'd be happy to do it remotely rather than travel to Austin or whatever. I mean, I think we'll see it again in the future there as well.
It seems like the same access to justice ideas and concerns would apply to the appellate courts, you know, just with a little different circumstance. I know El Paso has been offering video arguments for years. I've never taken them up on it, but I know some lawyers that have. I think they were pretty happy with the way that went even years ago.
Right. Well, I don't know if you've paid attention to the appellate Twitter storm about the U.S. Supreme Court telephonic arguments this week. There's a lot we could talk about that, but I'm super happy that ours are on video and you guys have a handle on the production and there are no extraneous noises happening in the background.
No toilets flushing.
I probably shouldn't say this on a podcast, which is recorded, but I'm going to anyway, which is I was really disappointed that the U.S. Supreme Court did that via telephone, not so much because it was telephone, but I think it's harder to do it that way. I think the justices' experience might have been better on camera because if you'll watch the Texas Supreme Court oral arguments, they were peppering questions back and forth, just like they would have been doing in the courtroom versus the, okay, it's your turn for your two questions. You know, I was reading appellate Twitter and I think everybody thought it worked and was, I think maybe everybody was just excited it was live. Maybe it worked, but I kept saying I was waiting on the call from John Roberts. I was hoping to get a call to say, hey, can you tell me how this works? And maybe he would ask even if we would run the production behind the scenes. We'd have been happy to, but maybe someday we can get them convinced to do it via video, but I think I'm happy we went that way and I'm happy our courts have gone that way. And I think they are happy as well.
All the reviews I've heard have been overwhelmingly positive for the way that every level of the Texas court system has done it. I haven't heard anyone complain about being on video versus something else.
That does sort of take us though to sort of the next level. I mean, we don't know exactly how long we're going to be in the situation we're in. even though things are starting to open up, they're not just going to reopen and suddenly everything's going to go back to the way it was. Before we started recording, we were talking a little about how are we going to handle jury trials. And the Travis County Civil and Family Courts just issued a new order saying there won't be any in-person live jury trials until at least August. This is hot off the presses. I'm seeing in lawyer discussion groups I'm in, you know, this question is being asked every day. What are the rumblings that you're hearing at OCA about how or when we can expect jury trials to continue?
Yeah, this is the hardest thing. It's pretty much what's consuming me every day right now. We issued guidance on Monday allowing courts to resume in-person proceedings on June 1st. They can only do that if they can't do it remotely. So we're still going to try to continue the remote. And they have to have a plan for how they're going to basically keep people safe in the courtroom. And we've given them kind of a guidance on what that looks like. But we've still said no jury trials until further guidance. And so we're working very hard to get to them guidance. But it's so tricky because to get to a jury of 12, let's just set aside the trial and deliberation point. To get there, we've got to summon in probably maybe 100 people, which means 100 people coming together generally in one spot, which we've got to have 6 feet of distancing. We've got to have other precautions in place. You know, are we going to go to the Coliseum or wherever, the community college? Where are we going to do that out? Because many courts don't have rooms large enough to do that. When we get to Voir Dire, how are we going to do that? How are we going to fit even 40 people in a room? Because not to say if someone has better math than me, they can correct me. But for 12 people, if they're standing on the wall, some of them are standing on the wall, it takes 306 square feet. So 40 is going to take somewhere around 1,000 to 1,200 square feet. How does that affect you as a lawyer when you're picking a jury? You know, you can't see the people in the back. They're kind of disengaged. It's the challenges to doing this are significant. And then you go to say, well, okay, well, let's think about doing some of this online. Well, then, you know, you hear from others saying, oh, I can't possibly do voir dire online. I'm used to seeing them in the courtroom. How's this possibly going to work? So there's a lot of unanswered questions. And we've convened a group of about 30 practitioners, judges, clerks, representing all portions of the bar to kind of help be an advisory group to us. And I just spent the last 2 hours on the phone with a Zoom call with them, just talking through. We got through summons qualification and voir dire, and that's it. We didn't even get to the trial. And we didn't really even get through those. We just sort of raised a bunch of issues. But I have said, and I'll continue to say, I think we will see jury trials this summer. I don't know what they'll look like. I don't know if there'll be some mixture of online and in person or reduced jury sizes where parties would agree. Maybe some even looking at whether or not we look at reducing peremptory challenges by agreement so that the jury sizes can be small, jury voir dire sizes can be smaller. So I think we've got a lot of issues. Our hope is to get some guidance out to the courts in the next couple of weeks so they can start summoning jurors if they wanted to earlier, sometime in June or July. But it is the difficult nut to crack. Everything else sort of seems, even though we spent weeks working on the other in person, everything else seems easy now compared to this because, you know, at the end of the day, it's not just about being able to do it. It's also being able to keep the jurors who come in safe as well as everybody else that's there. And even more importantly, letting them feel like we're keeping them safe because people are not going to show up if they don't think we're keeping them safe. And so we've got to take the steps to be able to reassure them of that. And that's kind of what we're trying to put together and get in place. So we'll see. Stay tuned for more on that. But we're certainly working our hardest to get something up and operational.
It's a great point about keeping the jurors safe. The other thing that comes to mind is when I see people asking this question about when we're going to be able to start up jury trials again, is a lot of these folks kind of forget that there is that buildup and lead time in getting the prospective jurors in the building to start with.
Right.
So, you know, you can set these target dates for jury trials, but you've got to have enough notice time out there to bring the veneer in.
And, you know, the other issue with that we were talking about today is the mail is slower right now. So, you know, whereas it might have taken 3 to 6 weeks before, now we're talking probably 6 to 8 weeks. You know, we were talking, I mean, the issue is, so here's a stat for you. Texas courts every day bring in 325,000 people per day to a court building. If you add the municipal courts all the way through the appellate courts, that is our estimate based upon real numbers from several courthouses. So that's 1% of the population coming in every day. We don't have a choice but to get it right because we believe we are the government entity in the country that compels the most people to come together. You know, not any other government entity does that versus I might be able to go out and get my haircut, which is not really necessary for me, but go out and get my haircut today or go out to a restaurant or whatever. on my choice. I get to choose to do that if I want to. Now we're talking about compelling tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to come together. We don't have a choice but to get it right. So we're trying to take our time, make sure we do that right. And especially with the jurors, maybe, you know, we know who shows up to jury duty. It's people who are in vulnerable populations many times and other things. And so we've just got to, we're going to take our time. We're going to get it right. I mean, we want to get jury trial started as quickly as possible, but it's got to be right. Chief Justice has been clear about that. Presiding Judge Keller has been clear about that. I mean, really, everybody's been clear about all in the way. We've had conversations with the governor's office. They're certainly supportive. And quite frankly, if all the state courts in the country get this wrong and 3.3 million people show up at a courthouse tomorrow, which would be the estimates for the country of how many people show up, we will set the whole country back. Mm-hmm. So, and we'll have a second wave just because the courts did it wrong. So the pressure's on and we're doing our best to try to get it right.
I hadn't even considered. Those numbers just don't even exist in most lawyers' minds.
No.
And the fact that that's probably right. I mean, you're putting a lot of people together, 3 million people. I want to commend OCA. And I know you guys do a great job behind the scenes day in, day out, but just critically important work. And talk about just a Herculean task that you all are taking on. That sounds like a bit of a cliche, but I think it's true. But I'll say I've been impressed with how involved you all have been in bringing the judiciary in, getting them comfortable with this idea that I'm sure a lot weren't comfortable with to start with. And then we as lawyers, I think it's not ideal in some ways. I think we have to accept that this is the reality that we're dealing with. And whatever it winds up looking like when jury trials resume, I mean, it's really in everyone's best interest that they do resume, I think. And there has to be some adjustments to what that looks like going forward. It was interesting to see in the guidelines, though, that it was anticipated that jury trials could resume this summer, but yet obviously staying very open-ended on that necessarily based on what we've seen in the last 2 months.
I think we would love nothing more than to start jury trials back June 1st and the way that we did them before and letting every court do that. And quite frankly, to some degree, we have to get them up quickly because criminal defendants in jail have a right to a jury trial and they've been sitting there now for a couple months without it. So we've got to get it going, but at the same time, the bigger issue is we've got to get it right. Anyone can go Google the story from last week in Ohio where the judge tried to have what we believe is probably one of the very first, if not the first jury trial to start back during the pandemic. And it was a complete disaster. You know, while they were picking the jury, the defendant fell over and passed out and then they decided he might have coronavirus. And now has exposed everyone in there anyway. The chief said today on a meeting with the local administrative district judges, the confidence in the judiciary and the rule of law are at stake. We have to get this right. We can't do that where we say we're going to start back and then it's a complete disaster. No one will ever show up if we do that. So we're going to take our time. We're going to get it right. Then we're going to have jury trials when that happens.
Well, it's no surprise that Texas would lead the way in trying to get it right and getting it done. So you all are to be commended for your work in this area.
Absolutely. The fact that we don't hear about OCA in the news a lot is probably a good thing. It means that you guys are doing your jobs right because nobody knows who you are and nobody has seen anything behind the scenes that's caused a problem. So thank you guys for all you do.
Thanks very much.
So David, this has all been very informative. We do like to have our guests give a tip or tell a quick war story. We've gone a little long in this episode, but this has all been super great information, but I don't want to cut you off. I want to give you the opportunity to give us a tip or a war story that our listeners may be interested in.
Yeah, I think probably the tip, which probably everybody who was watching the third Supreme Court oral argument on the first day they did it would know, but as important is to check your internet connection before you have an oral argument. Make sure your internet connection is strong. As everybody probably knows, and I feel sorry for the guy who was the recipient of this, but we lost an appellate lawyer in the middle of the Supreme Court oral argument. I was sitting there, and as one of the co-hosts of that, we hear the sound of someone disappear, which you can hear on a Zoom call when you're a co-host or host. And I looked down thinking, who did we lose? And the appellate lawyer is gone. It was during the other attorney's argument. So I texted the chief, which was sort of the plan, and said, oh, we just lost so-and-so. And so the chief says, okay, everyone, we need to pause. So then he got back on. So then it was like, oh man, that was terrible. So then we move on and then we're in the middle of his argument and he's in the middle of a sentence and there he goes, gone again. And so we pause the timer, we wait for him to come back and thankfully got back. But we realized two things. One, make sure you have a strong internet connection. And second, make sure you have the phone number to call into if you need to do it the old-fashioned way. It all worked out in the end, but it was definitely, I'm sure, pretty stressful for him and certainly stressful for us on the back end trying to make sure it went smoothly. So that would be my tip for you, especially in this day and age of oral arguments remotely, is make sure you have those things in place before you argue.
I feel like that's the technological equivalent of passing out at the lectern in the middle of your argument. It sounds terrible.
Exactly.
That's some great advice.
We really, really appreciate you coming on today. And we know you have a million Zoom calls a day these days. So thank you for making this another one on your schedule. We want to thank our listeners for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying this podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate us and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. For those of you who have rated us so far, we really appreciate it.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you the best and hope you are all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.